Climate change is no new topic. It's been talked about for decades, with its impact felt in communities and ecosystems across the world. The effects of climate change on habitats, wildlife, and people have been dramatic. And as the global temperature rises and sea ice melts in the Arctic, wildlife and people face challenges to adapt. In this podcast, we travel to Point Lay, a small village in the North Slope of Alaska, to talk about how climate change is affecting Pacific walruses. We discover how melting sea ice is causing walruses to haul out of the water closer and closer to Alaska Native communities. We will hear from local Point Lay residents, as well as marine biology experts, as they tell us what's happening to walruses and their ecosystem. This report on climate change and the walrus haul-out in the Arctic is produced by Alaska Team Media Institute in collaboration with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and is supported by funds from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. I'm your host, Danielle Duclos.
This is real new to us nowadays. In our days, it was different, you know.
You take more risks now? There's less ice?
You step on it, you're gonna sink through because there's water underneath the snow. And the only time you can go out is only when it's frozen or solid enough, you know, to walk on.
You're always aware of the wind and you're always aware of the water currents.
You have to have respect for your land, you know, and your territory.
It's hard, but no, you only can take it one day at a time. The way I see it now is it's up to us and the elders, what's left of our elders here in the village, is trying to keep the language and the culture alive.
Melting sea ice in the Arctic is a relatively new challenge for Point Lay residents. Arctic communities are adapting to a new reality because their traditional ways of providing for themselves have changed. In our first story, Atme speaks to local residents about their take on how this impacts walruses, as well as Jewel Garlick Miller, a marine biologist who studies and monitors walrus behavior in their habitat. To share this story, here is youth producer Riley Taylor.
Imagine a beach with tens of thousands of displaced walruses on it, all vying for a spot to rest. That's what's been happening every summer and fall since 2007 near Point Lay, Alaska.
They gathered here. We had a few times that they gathered, a few here. Boy, they say, oh, lots of walrus up north. But there were like 10, 12, not, you know, 40,000.
That's Point Lay resident Alan Upikson. The walruses haul out on barrier islands, which are a specific type of coastal landform, a thin sliver of land along the coastline that provide a barrier between the ocean and the mainland. The islands are usually mostly flat. They are created by waves and the sand in the ocean. The barrier islands at the very northwestern edge of Alaska, near the village of Point Lay, have been a substitute for sea ice as Pacific walruses look for a resting place.
Due to a warming climate, sea ice is melting at a rapid pace. According to a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report, the amount of sea ice in September 2019 was tied as the second lowest on record.
Jewel Garlick Miller is a marine mammal biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He has been monitoring the walruses as these changes to their natural habitat take place.
And so for walruses, which are very, their distribution is heavily influenced by sea ice because they like and need sea ice to haul out, to pull themselves out onto ice floes to rest between feeding bouts. So if there's no sea ice, it's very difficult for them to stay offshore.
Sea ice is not only melting faster, but also taking longer to freeze back up. Garlick Miller says, historically,
sea ice would form in the Chukchi Sea near Point Lay earlier in the season and then spread out into the Bering Sea.
So much of the ocean was covered by sea ice. Over the past several decades, we've started to see ice forming later and later in the season and breaking up earlier and earlier, and the total extent has also shrunk quite considerably.
Garlick Miller's colleague, Chad Jay, a walrus biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, says we're getting longer and longer periods of open water during the summer and fall months.
Walruses use sea ice to rest upon, to give birth, and it also provides them a platform to be able to maintain themselves offshore and feed in areas that they need to be where the food is rich.
Walruses are bottom feeders. They use the whiskers on the tips of their snouts to feel the ground along the shallow ocean floor, and when they feel clams and other invertebrates, they suck them into their mouths. They swallow the soft part of the animal and spit back out the shells. However, with the loss of sea ice comes the loss of walruses' ability to use a large portion of their habitat, as females and young are not suited to spending long periods of time in open water. With summer sea ice melting and receding far offshore over deep Arctic basin waters, walruses' access to shallow feeding locations is limited by how far the haul-out sites are from food. If food is too far from a resting place, then walruses won't travel to it. So less sea ice means less food, and this poses a problem for the sustainability of present and future generations of walruses.
Historically, there's always been some sea ice over shallow continental shelf waters where they feed, but we're starting to see a regular pattern now in late summer, early fall, where the ice retreats so far north that it's beyond the shallow waters where walrus feed, and so walruses are forced to come to shore to rest.
This poses many problems for Pacific walruses. There's some risks and consequences associated with the formation of these big coastal haul-out sites. There's a lot of activity along the coasts. Planes, boats, even terrestrial predators that walruses haven't historically had to face, including grizzly bears.
And so what happens is that these large aggregations are vulnerable to disturbance events.
Less sea ice means more walruses packed along the coastline and higher amounts of ship traffic, sightseeing, and airplanes. All of these activities create a perfect storm for the walruses.
Something can startle them, and they tend to spook as a herd. And when you have many thousands of animals rushing to the water, we sometimes see some trampling injuries and mortalities.
Larger walruses rush to the water and trample the young walruses. Point Lay residents like Leo Ferreira III and Perry Pickock have seen the haul-out firsthand. They know that walruses' livelihood revolves around sea ice, and year after year, they watch their environment change.
And then we just realize that there is no ice, and that's why they're coming to shore, because we know usually they're on the ice all the time.
You know, they gotta rest somewhere. Our ocean itself is running out of ice.
The USGS reports the total worldwide carbon emissions was approximately 32.5 billion metric tons in 2017. With CO2 in the atmosphere, it can lead to a greenhouse gas effect, which causes the planet to warm. This is why the ocean's sea ice is melting more and more every year and taking longer and longer to freeze up. Willard Neckock was born in Point Lay and lived there for about 30 years.
You know, the winter, the ice is very, you know, bad on all the animals that live on the ice, the walrus, the seals, and it just terrible.
Point Lay residents realize they can't stop climate change, but they say they'll continue to take care of their resources the best they can. For the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm Alaska Teen Media Institute reporter, Riley Taylor.
Thank you, Riley. This podcast is supported by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And I'm your host from Alaska Teen Media Institute, Danielle Duclos. Now we'd like to explore the cultural connection Alaska Native communities have to these massive marine mammals. Walruses are an integral part of subsistence harvesting, especially in communities like Point Lay and Savoonga. We'll hear from youth producer Kendall Stormo as she talks with residents about their dependence on walruses as a natural resource and the relationship Alaska Native cultures have with these important animals.
Arctic marine mammals have adapted in order to live in harsh environments. They have also had to adapt to the ever-changing climate. Pacific walruses are the second largest pinnipeds, which are carnivorous aquatic mammals. Adults weigh more than 2,000 pounds, and they are a valuable subsistence resource to coastal native villages in Alaska. Students at Cully School in Point Lay, Alaska, meet after school to learn the dances of their ancestors. The walrus dance is a favorite. Alaska Native communities have a deep cultural bond with subsistence harvesting and walruses in particular, as seen through their songs, stories, and dances. Jewel is a student at Cully School.
We hunt for our food, because it's all we got if we don't have enough money. Because there's not really much jobs up here.
From being a source of nutrition to being a medium for making tools and art, Alaska Native communities understand the importance of walrus and their many uses. Walruses are one resource that have nurtured these communities for many centuries.
Walruses are sought after for as a great food resource, and also in the past, and people used to do all sorts of things like make, and they still do today, is make boats and things out of the skin. They utilize a lot of the walrus in many different ways. The ivory is provides some much needed economic benefit in the communities. People make beautiful handicrafts, which they can sell.
That is Joel Garlick Miller, a walrus biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He has been a specialist in managing walruses in Alaska for about 30 years now. Legally, Alaska Native peoples living along the coast are the only ones allowed to harvest walrus and carve and sell walrus ivory. Each year, tourists take home ivory figurines of polar bears, seals, Alaska Native hunters, and walruses to display in their homes. Because the cash economy in many Alaska Native communities is relatively non-existent and poverty levels are typically much higher than the national average, many residents rely on subsistence hunting and the use of each part of the animal. Brian Ruckuck Jr. of Savoonga, Alaska, says the way his community harvests walrus has stayed about the same throughout time and is hopeful they will continue to harvest walrus in the future.
Of course, the meat, the food we harvest out of the walrus, it has good nutrients, and it always will have good nutrients. Seems like anything out of the ocean, the mammals we catch, even the fish and the birds, it's like, for instance, they have vitamin C, a lot of iron, and a lot of protein, which gives us good health, and of course, good eating. But you have to grow up with it. And I don't think there'll be any kind of change in the upcoming generations to come. Because we've been carrying it down generation after generation.
Savoonga is known as the walrus capital of the world and is located on St. Lawrence Island, along with the village of Gamble. For those living on St. Lawrence Island, at least 70% of their food is from the ocean, according to the State of Alaska Division of Community and Regional Affairs. This makes walrus a vital source of nutrition, as well as being an economic resource.
We share it. Each and every catch we get from the walrus, we tend to share it with our extended families, friends. Every time we do harvest a walrus, you know, we invite the village to come over and take a portion of it to feed their family, because we do love to share whatever we harvest with each other, mostly to our elders that, you know, or people that are unable to go out hunting because, you know, maybe they don't have a boat or they're a little too old to go out. But we do respect our elders, and if they are in need of food, we go out and harvest for them.
We just heard from Point Lay resident Willard Neckock and Brian Rockook of Savoonga. Along with taking only what you need, another value throughout Alaska Native culture is respecting your elders.
I just love to take care of our elders and people who are unable to go out hunting to enjoy the food that we hunt. And especially the walrus too, you know, it's good staple food all year round, especially during the winter, for which, you know, some of the skin, the meat, and the blubber that we use to take home, it keeps us warm during the winter if we're out hunting, fishing, ice fishing, and, you know, just enjoying the country that we have up there.
Walruses are an essential cultural and subsistence resource to Alaska Native people and are considered to be sentient beings that understand human speech and their treatment before and after harvest. The communities that depend on walrus have great respect for the human-animal relationship and are grateful that walrus choose to offer themselves for harvest.
All our food that we have, that we harvest, are 100% pure, natural food. And we enjoy it. We love it. And that's why we want to make sure that, you know, we don't over-harvest and waste any of the food that we solely depend on each and every year. I'm happy I'm part of our lifestyle out here on the island, where we're a part of the system here. I'm hoping that won't change in the future, but I know that we'll still be harvesting it for our future and generations to come.
For the Fish and Wildlife Service and from Alaska Teen Media Institute, I'm Kendall Stormo.
Thanks, Kendall. And to close out the podcast on climate change and the walrus haulout, we have a final piece from Alaska Teen Media Institute's senior producer, Quinn White. She speaks with community members from Point Lay and Savunga, and we'll hear from biologists about how communities are working to monitor and protect the walrus population from societal disturbances, over-harvesting, and the effects of climate change.
As rural Alaska communities such as Point Lay depend on walrus to continue their way of life, rising sea levels and rising temperatures threaten the vitality of the species. These shifts have caused Pacific walrus to change their behavior. Walruses have been congregating near Point Lay since 2007, enticing visitors to fly over and take pictures of the walruses. In 2016, the tribal president of Point Lay, Leo Ferreira III, requested that outsiders not visit their community in order to prevent disturbing the walruses and causing stampedes, which can be deadly.
So we had an unknown amount of aircraft coming to Point Lay, which now were not landing, but flying by and disturbing the walruses. And we noticed that during that time that the airplane traffic was causing stampedes, and I witnessed it with my own eyes, and some other residents witnessed it with their own eyes. It was not good because these walruses that we seen that were dead, they seemed pretty healthy to us. And then the only thing we could think of was the airplane that caused the stampede, and then it was kind of heartbreaking to see that these animals were just being wasted this way in this manner.
Although it is hard for scientists to tell exactly what the walrus population may look like in the future, we can take measures now to help prevent drastic disturbances to the walruses. Chad Jay with the U.S. Geological Survey says biologists use satellite radio tags to track walruses on an hourly basis to see where these large mammals go to rest and forage and to detect any variation in their distribution.
And in addition to the actual movements of individual animals, these tags also have a pressure sensor on them that gives us information about their diving. And so that's important information for us because then we can use that to determine kind of what the activity budgets of the animals are under certain circumstances, under environmental change, and whether sea ice is present or not, whether they're hauled out on land or not.
Biologists also have demographic data from 1975 to 2015. This allows them to see how the populations are being impacted over time and how environmental changes coincide with changes in population. This data is used by wildlife managers in communities like Point Lay to make decisions to help protect the marine mammals.
That community has really taken a kind of a stewardship and a lead there in seeing that, you know, planes and boat traffic and things are mitigated so that they're not, you know, disturbing the walruses. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service is working with the Eskimo Walrus Commission in these communities to try to, protect these areas that are used more often now.
Willard Neckock, a former Point Lay resident, has taken a very active role. He has been engaged in multi-village discussions about harvesting and has monitored air and ship traffic to prevent the walruses from being spooked and stampeding. He's maintained good communications with the U.S. Coast Guard, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to ensure that the walruses will be protected.
Young walrus are like our kids, you know. We want to make sure that we protect them, make sure that they continue our heritage or tradition here. And just like the walrus too, they have their own way of repopulating, and with, you know, planes and ships causing stampedes that reduces the numbers significantly, you know, each and every year. In fact, we can continue to enjoy the awesome gift that we harvest each and every year from the ocean. just great to know that, you know, we're doing our part in protecting walrus, not only for our village, but villages from, you know, the south and villages further north.
The preservation of Pacific walruses is essential in making sure Alaskans can continue to depend on harvests of sea mammals.
We asked, you know, for them to, you know, harvest just what you need. That's all we're asking.
Residents in coastal communities from northwestern Alaska have a long history of working together to ensure hunters are being mindful about their harvests. Brian Rockuk Jr. is a resident of Savunga, Alaska on St. Lawrence Island.
Both villages out here on the island, Gamble and Savunga, we do have committees. And then they discuss about carrying down the traditional values about having trip limits, and that we're pretty much happy about. And we're just like, I don't know how to compare it, but just that we're part of the ecosystem out here, and we're the real, seem like, we manage what we take. We can't go over what we need up until each and every individual or family member meets the need of harvesting walrus. That's it. We're done. On to the next one, like a bearded seal. And some seabirds or waterfowl, and then everything's on a seasonal basis. We're always out hunting or fishing every season. So leave out the walrus because we have enough for the season or two. So the walrus will always be around us, among us. The way I see it. That's my own perspective.
Both Rockuk and Nekok expressed how residents of their villages are doing their part in protecting walrus in the region. But Nekok says this complex issue requires help from larger organizations.
We will help protect the walrus. We'll maintain the population, but you know, sometimes we need help from FAA and or U.S. Coast Guard.
It's clear that many Alaska and Russian communities rely on subsistence hunting, and organizations from both countries will have to work together to find ways to navigate changes in walrus behavior. Joel Garlic Miller, a marine mammal biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, explains why this is a necessary step moving toward the future.
As sea ice disappears and walruses become more and more dependent on coastal environments, I think local conservation and management efforts are going to become increasingly important. We expect that walruses will probably occupy new haulouts. They'll pop up periodically, and they'll shift as food resources become depleted in one area, they'll be forced to move to another area. So I think our best strategy is to work collaboratively, both with our Russian colleagues and local communities to, you know, reduce disturbances at coastal haulouts, make sure that subsistence harvest stays in sustainable levels.
Garlic Miller says organizations in Alaska and Russia are working toward ensuring that communities will be able to continue to depend on Pacific walrus in the future.
We work with the federal aviation authorities to try to prevent airplanes from overflying haulouts. We work with the U.S. Coast Guard and oil and gas industry to try to minimize interactions with boat traffic and things. And in, you know, there's a lot of great community-based activities that are happening as well. And some of the most promising conservation management efforts are actually happening at the community level. We have the, some of these large walrus haulouts are forming very close to coastal communities, and in Chukotka, Russia, for the last several decades, they've started to develop their own management efforts to keep people away from the haulouts and prevent hunting-related disturbances, and guiding tourists and teaching them about appropriate behavior around these haulout sites.
Garlic Miller says St. Lawrence Island is working under the leadership of the Eskimo Walrus Commission. They are developing tribal ordinances, self-regulation of harvest, and working to build an infrastructure.
They're going above and beyond the what's required under federal law for reporting harvest, for example, but out of concern they're trying to ensure that the world knows that they're harvesting in a sustainable manner.
For the Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm Alaska Teen Media Institute reporter Quinn White.
Thank you, Quinn. And that's the end of our podcast. Thank you for joining us for this report on climate change and the walrus haulout in the Arctic. This youth report is brought to you through a partnership between Alaska Teen Media Institute and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, with funding from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Thanks to Alaska Teen Media Institute youth reporters Riley Taylor, Kendall Stormo, and Quinn White. And a big thank you to our mentors Rosie Robards, Cody Liska, and John Kendall. And thank you for listening. For Alaska Teen Media Institute, I'm Danielle Duclos.